Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. We bring you Joan Didion this time. Her career began at Vogue, and then she wrote for Life, Esquire, The Saturday Evening Post, The New York Times, and The New York Review of Books in the early years of her career. Her first novel, Run, River, was published in 1963, but she is best known for her nonfiction. Her early articles were collected into several remarkable books, including Slouching Towards Bethlehem in 1968 and The White Album in 1979. Other early nonfiction books include A Book of Common Prayer, Salvador, and Democracy, published in 1984. She and her husband, John Gregory Dunn, collaborated on many of their works, including several screenplays, most notably the film Up Close and Personal, which was adapted from Didion's book, Play It As It Lays. Her husband, John Dunn, died of a heart attack in 2003. Then, in 2005, Didion and Dunn's daughter died at the age of just 39. This devastating time resulted in Didion's celebrated memoir, The Year of Magical Thinking, which was a New York Times bestseller, won the National Book Award, and was turned into a Broadway play starring Vanessa Redgrave. Here's Joan Didion in 2001 as part of Portland Arts and Lectures at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall.
Thank you. I thought I would read a little bit from the preface to the book, which kind of more or less explains how it came about and why I was moved to put it together. And then I was going to read a part of it that was written in 1988, which seemed to have some relevance to what we've been going through the past week. Early in 1988, Robert Silvers of the New York Review of Books asked me if I would do some pieces about the presidential campaign just then getting underway in New Hampshire. He would arrange credentials. All I had to do was show up, see what there was to see, and write something. I was flattered. A presidential election seemed like a serious story, and no one had before solicited my opinions on one. Yet I kept putting off the essential moment, which was just showing up, giving the thing the required focus. In January and February, I was selling a house in California, which was an easy excuse. In March and April, I was buying an apartment in New York, another easy excuse. I had packing to do, then unpacking, painting to arrange, many household negotiations and renegotiations. Clippings and books and campaign schedules kept arriving, and I would stack them on a shelf unread. I kept getting new deadlines from the New York Review, but there remained about domestic politics something resistant, recondite, some occult irreconcilability that kept all news of it just below my attention level. The events of the campaign, as reported, seemed to have taken place in a language I did not recognize. The stakes of the election as presented seemed not to compute. At the very point when I had in my mind successfully abandoned this project to which I could clearly bring no access, no knowledge, no understanding, I got another more urgent call from the New York Review. The Democratic and Republican National Conventions were by then only weeks away. The office could put me on a campaign charter the next day. Jesse Jackson was flying out of Newark to California. The office could connect me in Los Angeles with the other campaigns. It so happened that my husband was leaving that day to do some research in Ireland. It so happened that our daughter was leaving that day to spend the summer in Guatemala and Nicaragua. There seemed no real excuse for me not to watch the California primary, and even to vote in it since I was still registered in Los Angeles County. And so I went to Newark and got on the plane. At a point quite soon during the dozen-some years that followed getting on that charter at Newark, it came to my attention that there was in writing about politics a certain Sisyphean aspect. Broad patterns could be defined, specific inconsistencies documented, but no amount of definition or documentation seemed sufficient to stop the stone that was our apprehension of politics from hurtling back downhill. the romance of New Hampshire would again be with us. The crucible event in the candidate's character would again be explored. Even that which seemed ineluctably clear would again vanish from collective memory, sink traceless into the stream of collapsing news and comment cycles that had become our national River Lethe. It was clear, for example, in 1988 that the political process had already become perilously remote from the electorate it was meant to represent. It was also clear in 1988 that the decision of the two major parties to obscure any possible perceived distinctions between themselves, and by so doing to narrow the contested ground to a handful of selected target voters, had already imposed considerable strain on the basic principle of the democratic exercise, that of assuring the nation's citizens a voice in its affairs. It was also clear in 1988 that the rhetorical manipulation of resentment and anger designed to attract those target voters had reduced the nation's political dialogue to a level so dispiritingly low that its highest expression had come to be a pernicious nostalgia. Perhaps most strikingly of all, it was clear in 1988 that those inside the process had congealed into a permanent political class, the defining characteristic of which was its readiness to abandon those not inside the process. All of this was known, yet by the time of the November 2000 presidential election and the onset of the 36 days that came to be known as Florida, every aspect of what had been known in 1988 would again need to be rediscovered, the stone pushed up the hill one more time. So that's from the preface, and then this was something I wrote that appeared in the New York Review in December 22nd, 1988, after the 88 election, which was won by the current president's father, if you remember. In August 1986, George Bush, that's the pair, traveling in his role as Vice President of the United States and accompanied by his staff, the Secret Service, the traveling press, and a personal camera crew, wearing baseball caps reading Shooter's Inc., and working on a $10,000 retainer paid by a Bush political action committee called the Fund for America's Future, spent several days in Israel and Jordan. The schedule in Israel included, according to reports in the Los Angeles Times and the New York Times, shoots at the Western Wall, at the Holocaust Memorial, at David Ben-Gurion's tomb, and at 32 other locations chosen to produce camera footage, illustrating that George Bush was, as Marlon Fitzwater, at that time the vice presidential press secretary, put it, quote, familiar with the issues, unquote. The Shooter's Inc. crew did not go on to Jordan. There was an official explained to the Los Angeles Times, quote, nothing to be gained from showing him schmoozing with Arabs, unquote. But the Bush advance team in Amman had nonetheless directed considerable attention to improving visuals for the traveling press. Members of the advance team had requested, for example, that the Jordanian Army marching band change its uniforms from white to red. They had requested that the Jordanians, who did not have enough equipment to transport Bush's traveling press corps, borrow the necessary helicopters to do so from the Israeli Air Force. In an effort to assure the color of live military action as a backdrop for the vice president, they had asked the Jordanians to stage maneuvers at a sensitive location overlooking Israel and the Golan Heights. They had asked the Jordanians to raise, over the Jordanian base there, the American flag. They had asked that Bush be photographed studying through binoculars, quote, enemy territory, unquote, a shot ultimately vetoed by the State Department since the enemy territory at hand was Israel. They had also asked, possibly the most arresting detail, that at every stop on the itinerary, camels be present. Some months later, I happened to be in Amman and mentioned reading about this Bush trip to several officials at the American embassy there. They could have, it was agreed, quote, cordially killed, unquote, the reporters in question, particularly Charles P. Wallace from the Los Angeles Times, but the reports themselves had been accurate. You didn't hear this, but they didn't write the half of it, one said. This is, in fact, the kind of story we expect to hear about our elected officials. We not only expect them to use other nations as changeable scrims in the theater of domestic politics, but encourage them to do so. After the April 1963 failure of the Bay of Pigs, John Kennedy's job approval rating was 4 points higher than it had been in March. After the 1965 intervention in the Dominican Republic, Lyndon Johnson's job approval rating rose 6 points. After the 1983 invasion of Grenada, Ronald Reagan's job approval rating rose 4 points. And what was that winter referred to in Washington as Lebanon, the sending of the American Marines into Beirut, the killing of the 241, and the subsequent pullout, was, in the afterglow of this certified success in the Caribbean, largely forgotten. In May 1984, Francis X. Clines of the New York Times described the view taken by James Baker, who was routinely described during his years in the Reagan White House as a manager of almost supernatural executive ability, the, quote, ultimate pragmatist, unquote. Quote, in attempting action in Lebanon, Baker argues, President Reagan avoided another, quote, impotent, unquote, episode, such as the taking of American hostages in Iran. And in withdrawing the Marines, the president avoided another Vietnam. Quote, pulling the Marines out put the lie to the argument that the president's trigger happy, Baker said. The issue, in other words, was one of preserving faith in President Reagan at home, a task that fell after the ultimate pragmatist left the White House into the hands of the less adroit. History is context. At a moment when the nation had seen control of its economy pass to its creditors, and when the administration-elect had for political reasons severely limited its ability to regain that control, this extreme reliance on the efficacy of faith over works meant something different from what it might have meant in 1984 or 1980. On the night in New Orleans in August 1988, when George Bush accepted the Republican nomination and spoke of his intention to, quote, speak for freedom, stand for freedom, and be a patient friend to anyone east or west who will fight for freedom, unquote, the word patient was construed by some in the Louisiana Superdome as an abandonment of the Reagan doctrine, a suggestion that a Bush administration would play a passive rather than an active role in any further dreams of rollback. This overlooked the real nature of the Reagan doctrine, the usefulness of which to the Reagan administration had been essentially political. Administrations with little room to maneuver at home have historically looked for sideshows abroad for the creation of what pollsters call a dramatic event, an external crisis, preferably one so remote that it remains an abstraction. On the evening of the November 1988 election and on several evenings that followed, I happened to sit at dinner in New York next to men with considerable experience in the financial community. They were agreed that the foreign markets would allow the new Bush administration, which was seen to have limited its options by promising for political reasons not to raise taxes, only a limited time before calling in the markers. They disagreed only as to the length of that time and to the nature of the downturn. One thought perhaps 2 years, another 6 months. Some saw a blowout. Blowout was a word used a good deal. Others saw a gradual tightening, a slow transition to that era of limited expectations of which Jerry Brown had spoken when he was governor of California. These men were, among themselves, uniformly pessimistic. They saw a situation in which the space available for domestic maneuvering had been reduced to zero. In this light, it did not seem encouraging that George Bush, on the Thursday before he left for his post-election Florida vacation, found time to meet not with those investors around the world who were that week sending him a message, The dollar was again dropping against the yen, against the mark, and against the pound. The Dow was dropping. Not with the Germans, not with the Japanese, not even with anyone from the American financial community, but with representatives of the Afghan resistance. Once in a while, I think about these things, but not much, the president-elect told the CBS news crew, which asked him a few days later in Florida about the falling market. Now, we'll have a conversation.
Hi, I'm David Saracen from the Oregonian. Welcome to Portland.
Thank you.
I've been enjoying your book very much. That's an unsolicited testimonial for the piles in the back. And I do wish it weren't quite so topical. The passage that you read from the introduction sort of captures the continuing theme of the book, the idea of how American politics and American life have developed such a sharp disconnect.
How politics got professionalized. And I don't know at what point this happened. I mean, because I only started watching it in 1988. But then it moved in an accelerated way after 88, certainly. But it was already clear in 88. And then it reached a kind of perfection all on its own in Florida, where you reduced. It was like a little haiku of American politics, where both parties were sending the same message to sending so much of the same message that they managed to reduce the meaningful electorate to a few hundred voters in Florida.
So we've got to this point where it's a narrow professionalized group which seems mostly to speak to each other.
They're speaking to each other, and increasingly their main interest or their main drive is to maintain themselves. I mean, it's like one of those clocks that that maintains its, you know, that doesn't really tell the time, it keeps the time.
Now, what makes this system so impervious as it stands now to efforts from any outside group to break in?
You mean like a third party?
Well, you talk about Jesse Jackson, you talk about your own connections to Jerry Brown and third party since.
Well, there was, I talked to a politician the other day who, you know, has run for president, and he thought that actually Jerry Brown, there was a very tiny window sort of in between, sort of around the time of after Connecticut and before New York.
This is in 92.
In 92, when Jerry Brown actually had a shot. Hmm. But it didn't happen he didn't have the organization, he didn't have the money, he didn't, he was running a kind of guerrilla campaign. It fell apart at that point. I thought Jesse Jackson actually had the party not run from him. But the party ran from him. You can't get to be the presidential nominee unless you are the choice of the party. I mean, it doesn't happen. I don't know that anybody really that there was a big groundswell of support for Michael Dukakis in 88. I don't think people, that all of us were saying, get Mike Dukakis in from the Massachusetts miracle. Yet he was the choice of the party, of the people who run the Democratic Party, and the reason he was the choice was that he was seen to appeal to centrist voters. They were already targeting that very narrow group.
So let me ask you a little bit about how Bill Clinton fits into this. You've got several chapters about his rise and about his difficulties at the end.
Well, he turned out to be a much more interesting character than the party had any right to expect. And in a lot of ways, a more effective president. I think he turned out to be a really effective president on the the level of communications. He, not Ronald Reagan, was a great communicator. But he, if you remember, he lost New Hampshire. And yet he came out of New Hampshire because he was the party's choice. They had decided before New Hampshire that he was going to, basically, that he was going to be it. And so he came out of New Hampshire, and he didn't win all the primaries all the way through the spring. Other people did. And yet there he was. Somehow the party misunderstood him and thought that they, this is why they misunderstood him, because he had been one of the founders of the DLC, and the DLC was basically them, what they wanted. It was the DLC and its ideas were how they were going to reach this hypothetical target voter.
Well, as wide as is the separation between American politics and American life. You know, it seems there's an even wider separation between American politics and the world. And this is occurring over a time when the American claims for a dominance and position in the world are just getting bigger and bigger through the last decades of the century. Mm-hmm. How does the process come to be so different from what's actually happening in the planet?
Well, it seems to me, I don't know what you think, but it seems to me that our foreign policy doesn't exist. It doesn't exist as a foreign policy. It exists as a tool, as a kind of backdrop for domestic politics. I mean, you can go get your picture taken in another country and show that you're familiar with the issues. But the test of it is how it plays at home. And I was really interested the other night on when Bush spoke. None of the comment afterwards was about the substance of the speech. None of the comment on television. What everybody was talking about was how it played at home. And Judy Woodruff was telling us what even Democratic consultants were saying. And Bill Schneider was talking about this could only be good for, the whole situation could only be to the good for, not only was his job approval way up for Bush, his job approval was way up, close to his father's at the time of the Gulf War, or above his father's at the time of the Gulf War at that point. One little flaw in his future, which was what was called the Bush economy, could now be the Osama bin Laden economy. So everybody had already just instantaneously translated this event, what happened to us, into terms of electoral politics.
Right after the passage that you read just now about George H.W. Bush visiting Jordan, there's an extended treatment of the episode at El Mozote in Salvador, which is basically a massacre of a village by the Salvadoran army, which is either not reported by the American press or the American press is forcibly driven away from the story and it retreats. And I wonder if that strikes you as a kind of metaphor.
What happened in this case, what happened at El Mozote was actually, the story was written by Raymond Bonner of the New York Times and by Alma Guillermo Prieto of the Washington Post. And the story actually ran in both papers for one day with photographs. They had walked into Morazan with Susan Micellus and with photographs. And then the administration denied that this had taken place and actually misquoted the embassy, et cetera. And the Times basically pulled the story. I mean, the story was dropped. And Bonner, who was there correspondent at that time in San Salvador, basically was like a dead person as far as they were concerned. He was not he was lucky to get an inch inside on any story. He finally left and He was finally pulled back to New York to work on the Metro desk in August. This had all happened in January. But then at a later point, much later point, after the hostilities in El Salvador were over and after the Reagan administration was over, the bodies were actually exhumed from this village, and there were, there were 700 largely women and children, and they had been massacred as Bonner and Alma Guillermo Prieto had said. At this point, there came one of those sort of shrill things where it fell into one of those polarities between left and right. It got to be one of those Vietnam backers versus Vietnam opponent stories, and it was because, and the reason it did was that we were still stuck at the time of Salvador and still now in the model of Vietnam and the model of the sort of polarities of Vietnam, of the Vietnam period. I mean, I noticed the other day in San Francisco that there were anti-war protests in Berkeley, and there were people talking about the anti-war protests in Berkeley on the radio, and already it sounded, it was like deja vu all over again. It sounded like 1967. They were saying the same things, and this was about basically a world that had, the world has turned since Vietnam, but we're stuck in the same stories.
You haven't traveled a good deal in Salvador. You wrote a book about it. You've traveled elsewhere in the Third World. As someone who lives in New York, someone who was in New York two Tuesdays ago when the attack occurred, do you get a sense here of the Third World sort of breaking through to American life?
Well, yeah, I do. I hesitate to use the word because I don't want it to be misunderstood, but it was almost poetically brought to our attention. There were a lot of ways and things that could have been bombed that might have done even more damage. We can all think of them, like a reactor or something, but nothing quite that symbolic. I have a strong sense that we better start noticing the rest of the world. And on its, and I was really impressed tonight on the local news. A professor at Oregon State had put together a very, in a week, he put together a course on the history of terrorism for 20 honors students. And it was so oversubscribed that they then are putting together a course for the public at large. I think this is a really good time for people to learn something about the world. I was really impressed.
Do you have a sense now that the texture of American life, the patterns of American life are going to feel more like Latin America or the Middle East or parts of Western Europe?
I don't think we have the will to do the kind of security that they do all through the Middle East. It's a funny thing about security. I went through security this morning, and I had my needlepoint scissors. They're about this big, taken. You can think of a lot of things that I had to show my picture ID a whole lot. But all those guys who got onto those planes had picture ID. it didn't. I don't think we're quite focused on the right things. I had at one time on my passport, some Middle Eastern countries that, and every time I went through the Paris airport, I was questioned at length about what I had done in those countries, why I had been there, if I was a writer, what had I written about, it was intended to find out if I had contacts in those countries. That's a kind of useful questioning it's not profiling, because I don't look like an Arab. It's a kind of useful questioning as opposed to taking somebody's manicure, scissors, or whatever, you know.
Now, why do you say that Americans wouldn't have the will to do that?
I think Americans tend to focus on picture ID. I mean, everything that's been mentioned to do at the airports doesn't seem as important, for example, as the one thing the pilots keep talking about. I don't mean the guns. I still have yet to understand how if you start shooting somebody on an airplane, you... but, no, I mean the thing about that they have brought up and that a few other people have brought up, which is that you can screen the passengers, but everybody who works for a caterer is on the planes all day long and does not go through that screening. I mean, that seems a place where we could tighten up. But we don't seem to focus on quite the right things. Well, we don't have any history with this, you know.
Well, it might be something we could pick learn up quickly, especially if something like this happens again. Yeah. Now, people have talked about the idea of a greater sense of apprehension in American life. And people of a certain age, which could sort of include you and me, know we do go back to a time not that long ago when Americans did live in a certain amount of fear, when there was an expectation of the possibility or even likelihood of things falling
annihilation,
out of the sky. Annihilation.
I mean, I was 10 when the bomb fell at Hiroshima, and it was like a nightmare to me for about 12 years. I mean, I really expected it to happen any night. I went to Berkeley, and I would look up the hill at the cyclotron, you know, it was all lit up. It was always lit up at night. And it was a sinister feeling. One thing that has struck me as sort of ridiculous in the past few days is the newspapers and television have been full of people talking about the death, but this is the death of irony, right? Well, actually, it might be the birth of some kind of real irony, you know, because to live with the bomb, you had to develop a fairly ironic point of view. It was all little children in 1945 became existentialists, you know. I mean, you know, there were bomb shelters. There were bomb drills in school, you know. I just came from New York. Everybody in New York is still in shock. And I think will be. A psychiatrist I know said that people would be to one degree or another for a year. And he was talking not just about people in New York, but about people all over the country, because it had threatened equally everybody. So I think that there will be a period of learning to live with the possibility of stuff. I mean, sometimes on television, I think there's a tendency with the 24/7 television to come away from it thinking we won't be afraid once we arrest that guy who tried to rent the crop duster, but if it's not the crop duster, it will be something else, you know.
So it sounds that this is likely to be something considerably more intense than going through the 50s and the early 60s.
Well, I don't know. I think it's hard to tell right now. I mean, it's hard to know how this is going to break down because we're getting, or play out, because we're getting, you know, because for his own purposes or reasons, the president is doing a kind of high rhetorical thing, which may not reflect what's actually going to happen, you know. It's really hard to know. I mean, certainly we knew after the towers were bombed once before, and a lot of this stuff came out in the trial of the people who were put on trial. A lot of the stuff about ongoing plans came out in that came out in that trial. But we didn't pay much attention. I mean, I just wonder if it's going to play down the same way again. If that got bombed, Oklahoma City, of course, that was homegrown, but it's the same thing.
So it sounds like we just somehow adapt to these things, assimilate them.
Well, how many times have you heard that America lost its innocence on September 11th? And how many times in your lifetime has America lost its innocence? I mean, yes, this. It's like what?
Well, you're... Wait a second, I'm trying to count here. Yeah. Well, you're talking about the president's rhetorical style here. Mm-hmm. And the book finishes with a terrific essay called God's Country about how religion becomes a pervasive theme of American politics, really in both parties, in 99 and 2000. And there's this sense of mission and values. I mean, listening to the debate for the last 2 weeks, does this seem very familiar to you?
Yeah, it did seem familiar. It's the news stories saying that, quoting Karen Hughes as saying that the president had found his mission. He felt very strongly that God had called him. I mean, it was sort of alarming. I mean, what was sort of alarming about it is that the place that where that all that rhetoric came from in the campaign was the wish to reach a certain group of voters, and so you kind of wonder whether it's coming from the same place.
If I ask you one more question, then we'll open it up for just a few from the audience. Mm-hmm. But you're on a short tour now. You're going up to Seattle, and then you'll go back to New York, where you've
right.
lived, and you'll continue to live. And I wonder if you could talk just a little bit about how one thinks of going on in New York at this point and how one thinks of going on in the country.
In New York, it's very odd because it doesn't exactly look like New York. If you look at that part of town, it doesn't look like New York anymore. It looks like, someone said to me, it looks like Cleveland.
My God, it was hit very badly.
Yes. Nobody, a lot of people were very critical architecturally of those towers, but they were certainly there, and then they weren't. And it's going to have a third world. The telephones haven't worked, for example, since that day. I'm not talking about in that area. In that area, my daughter was down yesterday and said that it reminded her of nothing so much as photographs of places where everyone is dead because a volcano has buried the town. Everything is still covered with ash. Everything is closed. It's a ghost town. But you get used to it. I mean, you get used to it. When I call Knopf, for example, which is, it's about five blocks from my apartment, and it's sort of like calling Knopf from Central America. It takes that long, the phone, you're going to get funny, and then you immediately push redial, and then sometimes you get through. But you very quickly adjust to that kind of thing, and I think everybody felt really good about being there. It wasn't a time when, if you live in New York, you wouldn't have wanted not to be there. I mean, it had a kind of unifying feeling.
See, we got a couple of questions from the audience here.
It seemed to me that in the White Album you wrote that the stories that we told ourselves to make sense of the world no longer made sense for you. And it strikes me that in your more recent books, your literary voice has gained a great deal more certainty. I don't know if you would agree with that, but it seems a more certain voice. For example, in political fictions, you can say that the work of Bob Woodward has no cerebral activity in it. And I can't imagine the woman who wrote the White Album being that certain. I'm wondering if you can talk about how you've developed that certainty.
I got a lot more logical when I started using a computer. No, it was in 1987, and I learned DOS, and DOS and WordPerfect were always right. This wasn't some kind of Windows Mickey Mouse that, where things keep popping around on the screen, and which I'm using now, and things keep disappearing from the screen if you don't use them often enough. I mean, no, DOS was totally logical. And it was always right. You were wrong. So I just got more logical, and that was when I did.
I think I've had people from DOS Tech Services tell me very similar things.
Really?
It was always right, and I was always wrong. Anyway. Yeah. You know, in one of the passages in the book where you're talking about the Kenneth Starr episode, you're extremely harsh to just about everyone whose voice comes out of Washington to try to explain politics to us.
Yeah, I think they're collaborators. I mean, you know, at the most blunt level.
How do they get so disconnected? I mean, it's true they all see each other, but occasionally they travel out and they...
They travel out, but they don't see anything, you know. They only talk to each other. I remember reading a piece once. This is when I was doing Miami, and I'd been spending a lot of time down there with the Cuban community. And George Will comes in for the day, right? And he has lunch with a couple of Cubans, and he talks about he writes this column which everybody, all my editors send me many copies of it because they think I'm in Miami and here's George Will on Miami, right? And he talks about the zest of Southwest 8th Street, you know, which is the main drag of Little Havana. The zest, and talks about trying black beans. and he brings the whole thing is some kind of wonderful tribute to the American dream, because these people who had come here and they were becoming such hardworking Americans. In other words, it was an assimilationist fantasy, right, that he was undergoing. Well, you know. Not the ones I was talking to.
So, sorry, I think some of us are still working through the concept of George Will eating black beans, but no,
trying.
Yeah. Well, with this situation, mm-hmm. about. You've got the same people coming to you, as you say, 24/7, explaining these things, and they're all talking to each other. Is there a source somewhere, is there a path somewhere for people who are trying to get a sense of what's actually happening in the country?
It seems to me there are a lot of places, things you can read and triangulate, you know. I mean, you can, and some people I know now are using the BBC homepage as their homepage, you know, because every time they look at the screen, it gives them a sense of what the rest of the world is saying, or what at least one part of the rest of the world is saying, which I think would be useful.
Well, one of the things that people say at this point about the internet and about the amount of information that's available at this point is that there is so much and there are so many different aspects to it, and that people who have reached the same conclusion you have about what's coming out of Washington have other roots.
Yeah.
Has this blown our impressions open, or what? Why hasn't it?
The internet?
The internet.
I thought the internet was really useful during the last campaign, there was so much. I mean, there were so many sites, and also you could look at, there were so many informational sites about campaign financing, about all kinds of stuff. But the really interesting sites during that campaign were the far right sites. Because I was so addicted to DOS, I didn't even have the net until about a year and a half ago. So that changed my life again. I am on and off it several times in the middle of a sentence. I mean, I use it for everything, to check everything.
Let me ask one final point about this. This book is about the narrowing of American politics. Mm-hmm. And how it's a smaller group only talking to itself. And there's a widespread feeling that in the week or 10 days following the attack, that it has, if anything, constricted, and that we've reached a sort of apotheosis, that there are no longer two parties looking a lot like each other. There's now basically a single party.
Yeah, I think that's they're not even occasionally saying anything. You know, as time goes by, and we unless we start bombing right away, I think as time goes by, thing is that this isn't going to resolve very fast. It's not going to simply disappear. It's not going to be one of those deals where, like, there was a thing, some senator wanted us to get out of Vietnam, and he was asked, how can we get out of Vietnam? And he said, easy. We say we won and we leave. And I think that the administration hopes that this will be the same kind of, whether they can say they won and leave, but I don't know that that will be the case. So I think that there will grow up very soon a sense of some opposition or debate about what is. I mean, there is absolutely no debate, it's true, and there's no even acknowledgement. I saw in the New York Times this morning that a revival of Stephen Sondheim's Assassins, which was scheduled at the Roundabout Theater, had been canceled because it was about presidential assassins. And another serious work, an older play, had also been canceled because it revolved around a terrorist incident. It was as if you didn't mention, you couldn't even mention that we had this attack without in some way betraying the country or being inappropriate or in bad taste. I mean, it seems to me that it would be really healthy if we acknowledged that we had, you know, that we lost something and it happened. Then we could move on.
Well, thank you very much for coming here to talk to us about
it. Thank you.
That was Joan Didion. She spoke at Portland Arts and Lectures in 2001. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear this or any other talk in the series, visit literary-arts.org. Crystal Liguori produces the Archive Project for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community, without whom this show would not be possible. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.